Alrighty, welcome back to another episode of the Lookout Podcast. My guest today is the incredible Laura Ward, who had a long fire career and amazing stories. And this the birth of this podcast happened at the Putting Pole this year, which is very cool. So thanks for coming on.
No problem. Yeah, we met at the, well, we met before, but at the end of Putting Pole this year, we started talking and telling stories with a couple other folks and led to some laughs and some memories. But yeah, I started as a GS1, I think is how that conversation started. I was hired in Oregon on the Lowell Ranger District, which I don't think exists anymore. I think it's the south zone of the Willamette.
Oh.
And I was a GS1 on a hand crew. When I got interviewed for that job, and it was the only job I was interviewed for in the Forest Service the entire time I worked for them.
Oh, really? The only time you had ever got interviewed?
Yeah, and then and I finished like 35 years later, so I always thought that was kind of funny that there were other applications, just no other interviews. But that is where I started, and I stayed on the Willamette for 5 or so years. I think they hired me in 86.
Oh, wow.
And I was 20 years old.
Oh, dang.
And then I had a son in 87. Jake is our oldest son, and he is 36 this year.
Oh, wow.
And stuck with fire, moved districts to Rigdon, was an engine captain, ended up on the Umpqua, and then had two more kids. Our son Logan is 32, and I'm really hoping I get their ages right.
Yeah.
And our daughter Aspen is 31.
Oh, nice.
So had a couple of kids while I was at the Umpqua. I'd moved there into a seven fuels position, and after our daughter was born, I took a position as an AFMO. Oh. Ops and fuels. It was one AFMO combined.
Oh,
and I went to TFM. And I stayed on the Umpqua for, close to 11 or 12 years. So 15 years in Oregon. And then my husband and I moved to Montana in 2000 on the Lolo National Forest. He went to the hotshot crew. He had been a hotshot in Oregon on the Wolf Creek hotshot crew.
Oh, cool.
He was assistant soup there. He took a detail to the squad leader position on the Lolo hotshot crew, and then I took a FMO job at Nine Mile Ranger District.
Oh, nice.
So we did that gig for a couple of years with three kids and both of us in fire. Presented some challenges in 2000. If your listeners were around, that was a really busy fire season on the Lolo.
Yeah.
And that was my first.
Man, welcome to the forest.
Yeah. It seems to always be a little bit of a trial by fire in this gig.
Yeah.
And then I stayed at Nine Mile in that position until 2010. And then I moved into the fire staff position on the Lolo National Forest. So it was the first time I had to drive into a city to work for the agency.
Oh,
I had a 5-mile commute before that and close to where the kids went to school. And then they were older and out of school and ended up coming into Missoula and working out of the supervisor's office.
You put it off for a pretty long time, though. That's a good accomplishment.
That was the goal. I think I was only motivated to put in for the job because I was afraid of who would get it. So, you know, let that motivate you to apply for positions in management.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's been a common theme, at least in my experience in the Forest Service, where so many people really enjoy the position they're in, but then they don't want someone else getting the position to run the show above them, and so they end up putting it in to kind of keep it from happening. And
yeah, I felt pretty strongly that the Lolo was a really good forest, and we grew really good firefighters. They had good fuels backgrounds, good aviation background, good experience with the hotshot crew if they had a chance to detail there. All of the districts were relatively busy districts, or they went and supported each other at least if they weren't having fire activity. So,
yeah,
it was a good forest to land on. I enjoyed my time on the Lolo.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and, I think everyone knows this, but, like, even thinking about it out loud, it's crazy that all the fire resources right around Missoula, like you said, the Lolo Shots, the Missoula District, the Helitech crew, the DNRC, and then and Smoke Jumpers.
Smoke Jumpers, the Fire Center, the Fire Sciences Lab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, it used to be MTD, so now it's NTDP, right, too?
Yeah, and Northern Rockies Coordination Center. It really is a hub of wildfire. And
yeah,
pretty funny, we didn't know that. We kind of moved to Montana blind, and we ended up in at 9 Mile, just right outside of Missoula.
Yeah.
And we took a gamble things would work out for Jim, and they did.
And back then, I mean, like, you could probably Google stuff, but, like, it wouldn't be that great of a search because it just, like, I don't even know if Google was really going around in 2000. It was more like Yahoo time, wasn't it?
Yeah, so
you wouldn't really get photos of a place back then, because now you can Google it and get photos. And you know, like the 9 Mile Ranger Station, for folks listening, if they've never been, it is beautiful.
Yeah.
So you guys landed.
I had no idea where I was landing when I took it, because I took it blind. I was actually commuting to detail on the Siskiyou when I got the job offer, and I said yes. And I hope my husband agrees.
Yeah. That's awesome. Oh, that's great. So he knew you put in, but he didn't know.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So he was kind of ready, but not for sure yet, huh?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was on a fire assignment.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. But the cool thing about probably being fire folks and probably your age, you're just up for anything. So you're like, oh, sure, change scenery. Let's go do it.
Yep. We knew we were ready to move. We'd been in Western Oregon for a long time.
Yeah. Man, yeah, good change of pace. Yeah, Western Oregon's beautiful. I've never really spent much time there, just kind of more passing through for fire. But I always wanted to spend a little time there, and maybe down the road might be more of my retirement gig, is taking this old beast out there into the coast.
Yeah, we enjoyed Oregon. I will say, you know, the last 15 years of the career were probably easier than the first 15, just because of having kids, working in fire, trying to get the qualifications. It was before, which I don't even know if FPM exists anymore, fire program management, where you have to have certain qualifications to even apply for a job.
Oh.
So that was challenging back in those days, because there weren't a lot of women, or there were women, but maybe they weren't partners with another firefighter and they didn't have so many kids. So juggling that in the early part of the career, I'm glad we were young.
Yeah.
It got easier because, like, by the third kid, Jim was able to take paternity leave. And that wasn't the case with Logan, our second kid.
Yeah.
And when Jake was born, that just didn't exist at all. And at that point, when that was 87, I was single. So the support network there was pretty limited.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. You know, like, I guess to set the stage for the listeners, that night that we were sitting in the pod or in the Airstream for the putt and pull, and then, you know, McClay Schulte was sitting where you were sitting.
Yep.
I was sitting a little more to my left, and Benji was kind of sitting right about here. And I didn't know. I mean, you've been in fire for a while, and I should have known better, I guess, but I didn't know that you were a boss for both those guys.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, when you came in, it was like a big kind of eruption in the trailer, and I was just happy to see you know, because I hadn't seen you forever, and the putt and pull is a big reunion. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, so there I was, you know, and they go, this awesome story. I was like, oh, Laura, you're amazing. And then, you know, those guys are like, you got to get on the podcast. And so I've been really excited about this one. And that story is, I don't know if you want to share that one, but that's a great story.
That's why I loop back around. The guy who interviewed me for that GS1 job, the only interview I ever had in the Forest Service, his name's Ross Williams. He worked in Region 1 also.
Oh.
He was the FMO up at Lincoln for about the same time I moved to 9 Mile.
Oh.
So our careers kind of traversed each other the entire time, but he interviewed me for that GS1 position. I got it. That was when I was 20, and then I came back and I was pregnant the next year. So instead of putting me on the fire crew, I put formaldehyde down toilets and campgrounds. That probably wasn't a good idea either, but that was the job they had for me, so I took it.
Yeah.
And then after Jake was born, which was in June, 6 weeks later, I went back out on the fire line. That was kind of the way things worked, because nobody really knew any better. Nobody had had a young woman on their crew that had a baby, and I was a temporary employee at the time, and then they needed to put me back on the crew, so they did.
Yeah.
So I went on a fire, and my son was 6 weeks old, and I was breastfeeding him. And my partner at the time, his dad, would sneak into the fire camps in a Nomex shirt so that I could continue breastfeeding Jake and keep the milk production going, if you don't know how that whole biology works.
Yeah.
And then when he couldn't do that, I would have to pump milk and just toss it. So I'd go take a break, be discreet, pump milk and toss it in the woods, and put the breast pump back in my lunchbox. And Ross saw the breast pump in my lunchbox one day. We were on a fire in on the Wenyima National Forest, so wasn't able to tie in with my partner, see Jake, and continue breastfeeding. So I was pumping twice a day and taking relatively long breaks to do it. So I can understand where Ross might have had this thought.
Yeah.
But he approached me at one point on the fire line after one of these breaks, and he accused me of smoking pot because he had seen the bong in my lunchbox.
Oh, man.
And I was a little hormonal at the time, so I kind of let loose on him.
Yeah, don't blame you.
And pulled it out of my lunchbox, got in his face, like, "Do you want me to show you how this works?" But it was just an unusual situation for him as a crew boss and a brand new supervisor in the agency. He was as kind to me as he possibly could be. But he thought I was smoking pot because I had a breast pump in my, and he knew I had a kid. He knew the whole story.
So I'm just oblivious to what a breast pump looked like, I guess.
And pretty much. And he loves it when I tell that story. I think he's in Hawaii right now, or maybe in Washington.
Oh, is he?
He should be retired too. We're the same age.
Oh, nice.
So he would have retired within the last 3 to 5 years.
Oh, man. Congratulations, Ross.
Yeah. And I was hoping to make it to his retirement party, but I don't think he wanted me to show up because he was afraid I would tell that story.
You didn't want that story getting out? Well, now it's out.
No. But like I said, a lot's changed. So now we're more accommodating, I think, to young women who are starting families. Young fathers are able to take paternity leave,
which is
a huge thing, especially when you're growing a family.
It
was difficult, but I think the agency's really done a good job of addressing, making it more accessible for young families to feel like they're supported.
Yeah, totally. Because you experienced 6 weeks after childbirth.
Mm-hmm. And you have a 6-month-old.
Yeah, I have a 6-month-old right now.
And a 2-year-old.
And a 2-year-old, yeah.
Yeah, so you got to be there for your partner and your kids too.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, there's not a lot of great education out there for anybody, but especially for guys when you go through like human anatomy. You get through the basics of reproduction, but you don't really understand like the hormones and all the things that the female body goes through before, during, and after childbirth. And that's, with my wife, I was like, man, like, I wish I had a little more info on this. Like, we didn't, we covered every bit of the, urinary system, from the kidney to the nephron or whatever it's called, the whole track of like water in and urine out, through your whole body, and like the intricacies of your eyeball and all the little bones in your ear and all the little things, right? But like, we didn't, and I don't know, maybe we just don't have time for it, but it's like, it would be nice to cover something like that, like that part of the child reproductive system, because I think it'd be great for everybody to know, like, here's what to expect, you're gonna have like this big dump of hormones after your baby comes, and then when your milk comes, and all these other things that happen,
And as a new mom, you may be informed or not either, and it's different for everybody.
Totally.
And it is. That's if everything goes well. You're healthy. The pregnancy goes well.
Yeah.
The birth goes well. For people that have complications, I respect that it can be a lot more difficult.
Totally. Yeah, and even like milk production too. I mean, that's such a finicky thing. So like, that's a battle in itself, just keeping it going, because you take a break and your body's like, oh, we're not doing this anymore. So like, shuts the system down.
Yeah.
So like, you keep going. It was smart and hard though, And then for other folks who can't produce at all, then that's, a difficult challenge that they have to, work with and, find a formula that works for their baby and all those things.
Yeah.
Holy cow. I mean, there's way more to it than I ever knew,
Yes.
And then
it's
once
the greatest adventure in life, right?
It really is. Yeah.
Family.
Yeah. You feel like you're doing pretty well, typically like you got a career going, you may have a house and all these other things kind of set. And then you have, this experience, and it's like, holy cow, I don't know anything, it's so humbling, and it's like you said, but it's great, everything I've done life-wise, seems to humble me, even if I feel like I'm really prepared. Yep. You know, like fire, smoke jumping, track, college, all these things, you know, and now, you know, fatherhood. So,
well, and I felt very fortunate when I was eligible to retire, felt I had done the service I could do with the agency. Our first grandchild was born in the May after I retired, so I was available to help her parents when they went back to work and build a good bond with our granddaughter. And yeah, that was really cool. Fortunate to kind of come full circle back around.
Yeah, I'm hoping on the same thing. Like, it's funny. It's really, you know, far down the road for me. But it's like, man, I want to, like, because my mother-in-law has been huge, like, such a great help for us. And it's like, man, I want to be able to do that, you know, if my kids ever decide they want to have kids, you know. It's so, I don't know, it's just great being around kids. It's a whole different feeling, especially when it's yours. And one of my friends, he had kids earlier on. He told me, like, it's different, you know, when you have kids, because I had young nephews that I was helping out with. And, you know, I was like, oh, this is great. And he's like, it's even better when they're yours.
Yeah.
and he was right, you know.
Yeah.
Because everyone can be a little pessimistic, because there's always that, like, great thing about when they're not yours, you can give them back at the end of the day, you know. It's like, I don't feel that at all, you know.
Well, now it's been quite some time since we've seen Hallie as our granddaughter, and she's going to do an overnighter this weekend, and we're really looking forward to it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it is. It's okay to give them back, but you do start missing them after a while.
Oh, yeah. My daughter's going to have a hard time getting rid of me. If she ever decides to have kids, I'll be around all the time. She'll be like, go home. I'm like, I'm being here for you.
So, yeah, I mean, I was glad you were willing to have this conversation, because I think for a lot of the young women I worked with later on in my career, when they started families, no matter what the situation was, whether their partner was in fire or not in fire, some of them moved into dispatch, which is also a very demanding job and takes long hours in the summer and can be stressful.
And not that rewarding.
Yeah, and it can be somewhat accommodating to a young mother in the workplace, but you still got to sit in front of the radio or take care of orders or whatever the task is that needs to be met.
Yeah.
And then a lot of them moved out of fire. I've had a few women I've been close to since I've been on the Lola that moved into prevention, stayed with prevention, moved up at the forest level after they started their families, and still some young women that are in dispatch that came out of fire crews or hotshot crews and went into dispatch once they started their families.
Yeah.
So there are avenues if you feel like your body isn't ready to go back on the fire line, or you as a mother aren't ready to go back on the fire line.
Yeah.
I don't know, and maybe you can answer this, Luke, how well we're doing that with the fathers.
I don't know, because that was kind of the thing when I was younger, especially smoke jumping, you know, like the support for the fathers and paternity leave, I don't think was there maybe when I was smoke jumping, I don't think. At least the paid paternity leave.
Yeah, you would have had to take in your annual leave.
Yeah. So the paid paternity leave kicked in a few years back, and that's been really nice. I was able to take that. And so that's handy, but, like, man, yeah, I don't know. It would break my heart sometimes when I come back to the jump base, because there'd be, like, truck full after truck full after truck full of, like, kids and families waiting for the bros and, you know, to get their stuff unloaded and, you know, get in the truck and go have family time for at the end of 2 days, you know, and sometimes less depending on what the need was. Cause if you were a spotter and we were thin on spotters, you might get your one day, you know, and then come back. And that was like, I wasn't even close to being a father at that point in my life. But I was like, cool, that seems rough, you know?
Well, and that's pretty much what Jim experienced. Cause when we started our family and we were young, the Forest Service was going through a downsizing, and he wasn't in fire at the time. And we made a decision for him to get back in fire because it was going to be the most stable employment in the agency.
Yeah.
So, and he got back into hotshotting. He'd been on Redmond hotshots prior to that.
Oh, nice.
On a detail. So yeah, he went back into Wolf Creek IHC Job Corps program, but runs a hotshot crew out of Oregon.
Oh.
And then he stayed in fire and came to the Lolo Hotshots, like I mentioned earlier, when we moved here. And the kids were, I think, somewhere around 5 and 6 and 10, something like that, when we moved here.
Yeah.
And, he'd come home for 2 days, and then he'd be back up. And then when I started doing incident management teams and we both were in management, it became a real balancing act. He did incident management teams also as a division soup.
Yeah.
And rotated through with a couple other colleagues on the district he worked at. And I worked as a division soup on a team in Region 6. And then when I got here, I started pursuing operations section chief. So we had to balance that. And one of the funniest stories about balancing that is he went to Eagle, Alaska with incident management team on a fire. I'm not going to remember what year. It's the American River fire. But he went. I was up as an ops trainee, so my control over and my availability wasn't, you know, really mine. If I got called, I needed to go because I was working on a task book. And I got called while he was gone. So I had a friend I worked with. She was the forest aviation officer here on the Lolo. She came and stayed with our kids, brought her funny little poodles, nice. And watched the kids for a few days. But I ended up going to Eagle, Alaska. So Jim was driving out on a 100-mile dirt road, and I was going in on a bus on a 100-mile dirt road to the same fire.
Oh, whoa.
And we never saw each other, but we were, communicating. We knew we were going like this.
Yeah.
And that's one of the only times that we weren't able to balance it or, like, you know, make sure somebody was home or en route. Home before we took off. Another one was when the I-90 complex broke.
Oh.
And that was in 2005.
Yeah, yeah.
I was the FMO at 9 Mile at the time. I'd gone on an assignment as an ops trainee over to Idaho that afternoon. The I-90 complex started. It was 32 starts along I-90 between basically Frenchtown and Superior.
Oh, wow.
And he went out as a Type 3 IC. And I got a call from however old Jake was at the time, like scared to death.
Oh.
Because we live off the 9 Mile exit. So they're seeing big columns, dad's busy, mom's in Idaho.
Yeah.
And this is when I knew the agency had really changed. I turned to my IC and I'm like, I don't care what you say, I'm leaving.
You have to go.
And I was the only operations section chief with the team on that fire. And they have to have all their... They're supposed to have all their positions filled.
Yeah. Just like any crew, too, right?
Yeah, with fully qualified. And I'm like, I don't care what you say. I got to go. And he was very kind. He's like, I understand. Let me get you a driver.
Huge.
You've already been up, and you're going to have to go through I-90.
Yeah.
There were a couple of times there were challenges, but usually the people around us helped us as a family work through them. We always, I think, felt like we were... we were able to get the support we needed to bridge those gaps.
Totally. And that's kind of, to me, like just I'm a little bit of a history buff and been reading more of the older fire books. And it seemed like when the agency started, it was a lot more family central, I guess, you know, because you were like Sula Ranger District, for example, like there's a lot of pictures of that where it was like all these families are in these photos, you know, like, and it's like at the work center and what was a ranger station then, but it's like in the middle of nowhere. Your family had to live there too, so they like took care of you and your family, you know. And then for some reason, it got we lost that along the way. Because like when I first got in, it didn't feel like family. Family was definitely family second, like hard second, you know.
I think the nature of fire in particular changed over the course of decades. I will say, you know, back in the day, there weren't a lot of women in fire, so the women were, you know, the ones staying at the government house, supporting the family, taking care of the kids, and guys were going off on the fire. When I was hired, the agency had gone through something that I don't know if anybody remembers anymore. It was a consent decree out of California saying they had to reach parity with women and men in the workforce because they were discriminating against women in the workforce. And that consent decree came down, I think, in 82 or 85, somewhere in there. Yeah. And a lot of programs in the agency were built around recruiting women into some of the more non-traditional positions in the agency at that time into leadership positions.
Yeah, I was going to say, just from information that I kind of just got, like, I was around like 82, maybe even 81, because mm-hmm. I think it's when Deanne Shulman, first female smoke jumper rookie, was in 81 or 82. Yep. And which would make sense.
Yep.
It's funny because I was talking to Kim Maynard, who was the second, her and a rookie sis, I think, were the second two jumpers to female jumpers to jump. And she got the same thing. She like wasn't really a thought to her that there wasn't any like real female mm-hmm. jumpers. She was just like, I thought this is a cool job, I'm gonna go do it. And I was like, yeah, kind of same. Like when I first got into smoke jumping, I didn't think like it wasn't even a thought in my head that there wasn't that many female smoke jumpers. It was more like, girls must be smarter than boys, and this is proof, because you're not getting paid anymore. Yeah. You know, you're going through a hard training. There's not really much benefits that you get to a cool title. You know, like you're beating the crap out of yourself through training, and then you're having to work harder on a fire and haul more stuff off the fire, typically, you know. And like traditional smoke jumping is you haul everything that you brought with you off, which is over 100 pounds typically. And so it's like, I don't get paid more, but I got to work harder. So I just figured that, like, it's like, oh, girls are just smarter. That's why I'm not doing this job, you know? And, but yeah, it's kind of funny. So that must have been around that like 81, 82, like you were saying, when that, what'd you call it?
The consent decree. And it came out of California Region 5.
Oh,
but
gotcha.
It affected the agency as a whole. Yeah. And I can't say I was aware of it when I interviewed for that GS1 position.
I still can't believe you're the only person I ever met. I think that was a GS1.
But it, I would say the programs the agency had built around addressing that court order, basically, I definitely was benefited from that.
Because, this is great.
Yeah, they did hire and put a emphasis on hiring more women in fire, especially. And the first fire management officer I worked for at Rigdon was female.
Oh, nice.
And she went on to become a district ranger and a forest supervisor.
Oh, really?
So
good.
I certainly wasn't, I mean, I didn't graduate high school till 82, so I wasn't one of the first ones that they brought in to address that consent decree, but I would say I definitely benefited from it. I would also say, I know there were 5 women at Rigdon Ranger District, now the South Zone of the Willamette, that were hired around the same time, and I'm the only one that stayed with the agency in fire management.
Oh, yeah, just
getting married, having families, and went into GIS and left the agency.
Yeah, like I said, just not really having that support in the fire world. And mm-hmm. it's important to have a diverse group of fire folks, I think. You know,
I think so.
Like, not only for conversations, because, you know, a bunch of dudes, like, as I've been on all dude fire crews. And
I think the agency's better about treating families because they have more women in the workforce.
Yeah.
I think that helped the evolution of, and some laws that were passed by Congress. I mean, the Family-Friendly Leave Act and the amendments that have happened to that have really benefited fathers and mothers.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been huge.
But yeah, I think that diversity is really important. And I do think it has lessened over the last probably decade. I saw it while I was still working, and I retired at the end of 2019, and I just saw fewer and fewer women in fire in general, and fewer women in leadership roles in fire. When I came to the Lolo, I was there were 5 FMOs, and 3 of them were women.
Oh, wow.
There were leadership positions in the SO that were female. There's still 5 districts on the Lolo. There's 1 female FMO.
Oh, wow.
Out at Superior. And, yeah, we just...
like you said, just not the retention.
I also think the recruitment. I'll speak quite frankly. I think some of our hiring practices have just led us down a path where it's hard to fill jobs, for one. You take what you get on the cert. There's no time to do outreach and recruitment to really be effective.
Yeah.
And you're working through Albuquerque Service Center, and your ability to have control over what that cert looks like is limited.
Yeah, totally. And if you're not hitting all the boxes, there's that, I think it's an automated system that it first goes through, right? That if you don't even have your verbiage right, you could be saying exactly what you're supposed to say, but if you don't hit those right words that the system wants to see, it'll kick you loose. And you're like, I'm doing the job right now, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. And then I think one thing I want to tack onto that too is the role model thing. I didn't realize when I was really younger, but probably being a guy, you know, like the first exposure to smoke jumpers was Man Gulch. My dad read Young Men in Fire when I was very young. Like the first family hike was to Man Gulch.
Oh, okay.
So like, you know, I was already like, oh, here's guys doing this job, you know? And I think that kind of put the bug in my brain. But like, as a female or any person, if you don't see someone that looks like you doing a job, you might not associate that like, oh, that could be me someday, you know? So I think it's very important to have those roles filled, you know, with females that, so that like people like my daughter, if she wants to do it, she'd be like, oh yeah, I can be like Laura Ward, you know, and go do this leadership role, you know? I think it's really important to have that.
Yeah, I appreciated that the fire management officer I worked at Rigdon was female because she knew or she understood I had a young family. Well, I had one child, Jake, and I was single.
Yeah.
And so I was very motivated, and I was what's called a permanent seasonal. I was that then. I was very motivated to get a promotion, get on full time, get benefits. I had things I needed to take care of myself and my son.
I was gonna say bigger than you, you know?
And she played an important role in, you know, letting me know, you have the skill set to apply for this fuels job on the Umpqua. And it had a career ladder, so it was a 6-7, which was uncommon back then. Career ladders are very common now, but they weren't then.
No, I don't think even really when I started. And there was no fives on the whole BBRD. No perm fives in any, like, program that as far as I knew. And, like, there was this, I think it was a Fuels 5 in Lincoln. It was, like, the closest one to home. And I was like, and it was a battle to get it, you know. And it was, usually people had way more qualifications than a 5, but the there wasn't that many perms. And like you said, the ladder positions didn't exist. So it makes it tough, you know. I'm so glad they have those now.
Yeah, I think it's a big, I think it's a draw for candidates, applicants, to one, be able to be mobile if they are or work remote, and then to have a career ladder for them.
Yeah.
So they know there's a future.
Yeah, the future thing, right? Because I mean, how many people do you know that were just seasonals and they're like, well, I put in and, you know, for a couple of years, nothing. So now I'm going a different career path. Yep. You know, it's pretty easy to get derailed. Like when, and I'm wondering if that's kind of happening now with some of the female population. I have a feeling it is because some of the female firefighters that I worked with, a lot of them, you know, kind of started bumping the ceiling, just like all of us, you know, got bottlenecked at like the 6 or 7 or whatever it was a couple of years ago. And they're like, well, I guess I kind of go nursing and get some more free time. You know, I was like, I don't blame you.
Yeah, or better pay.
And better pay,
benefits.
Yeah, better schedule. You know, like, and I think a lot of us had that mutual feeling of being in these beautiful places fighting fire, but not actually being able to enjoy it. Like, I've been to a lot of amazing places and never on vacation, you know? Like, I hadn't been to Glacier until I pretty much got out of fire, you know? So, like, and it's right there, you know? Just never had the time. And then also, like, after fire season, it was hunting season, and then also I didn't really want to be camping anymore. You know, especially smoke jumping, you're always camping. So I was like, I don't want to be in a tent anymore, or even just, you know, in a sleeping bag. So, but then you get the itch again come spring. You're like, I'm ready to get back after it. But I don't know. Why do you think that we're not seeing as many females in these leadership roles?
Well, I do think lots of industries and agencies are dealing with a hiring problem where they just aren't able to fill positions. I mean, you see it when you look just at the service industry. Everybody's trying to hire. So I do think pay may be part of it. I do think the expectations as far as availability of the job may be part of it. I do think as far as specific to being in leadership, some of our hiring practices, again, like I mentioned earlier, it's not just at those lower grade levels, it's the higher grade levels too. You get two people on a cert for a fire staff position. you know, we could certainly do a better job of recruiting leadership in our incident management teams if we had the pool to draw from. When I was a ops section trainee, there was one other female ops section chief in Region 1.
Yeah,
I've known one female incident commander in Region 1 in
like
my career.
Type 1?
Well, they don't have types anymore.
Oh,
is my
understanding. That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah. And
Was it Diane Hutton?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, that's the only one I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and I worked with her when she was in the big hole.
And there have been a couple others nationally, especially Type 1. But it's certainly, and the operations section chief has still, I've met maybe two other ops section chiefs that were female. And for me, as I aged gracefully in my position, I bridged over to plan section chief and fulfilled that role on incident management teams because it was literally time to let somebody younger step into that operations section role.
Yeah.
Because if you do it right, it can also be physically demanding. I was ready to do sit reports and, make an IAP for somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did enjoy bridging over to plan section chief. It was just a different tempo and a different role in an incident management team.
Yeah, totally.
So I think it's like anything. It's complicated. Why aren't there more women in leadership roles? There just simply aren't that many women in fire in the agency at this point to draw from. And I do think it comes down to our hiring practices.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I would imagine it's probably the generation coming up with me would be at that level, should be at that level right now. Because, like, a lot of my friends and mentors that I came up with are, you know, like, do you know Joe Sampson?
Mm-hmm, yeah. I know Joe. Yeah, I worked with him on Diane's team.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so he was one of my first, like, mentors in fire, and he was an engine foreman, they called him back then, when I started. So, and, you know, now he's, you know, got his own team and stuff. Yep. So, like, yeah, between me and him, I'm thinking, like, you know, age-wise, we're not that far apart. And even in, you know, the Butte Jefferson where I was working, I'm trying to think, like, I think we had two gals, you know, on the whole crew back then.
Yeah, you know, succession planning is a big part, not only for those incident management teams, for fire as a whole, but also for the agency as a whole. And we are talking mainly about fire, the agency as a whole. I mean, every time I have this conversation with anybody, I got to remember there's no career ladder in rec. Yeah. There's no, you know, the other parts of the agency, timber and engineering, their ability for succession planning has just really been hindered tremendously.
Yeah, totally.
With the way the agencies dealt with their hiring since the past, 15 or 20 years?
Yeah, I was saying, and maybe it was like this before, but what I've noticed too is that the latter thing we're talking and training our own people, like we're getting so heavy on college degrees in some positions. Like I think a GIS position, I don't know if you can find one that's not like a 9/11. You know, I don't think there's like a GS-4-5 GIS trainee position out there. At least I haven't seen it, you know? So like, you know, even some of the ladder positions are higher ladder. So you have to have like a master's or something. So we're getting college students, but also like those college students, if they want to, can go out and make a lot more money in the private sector than with the Forest Service. Cause Forest Service can't compete.
Yeah. So just like an engineer.
Just like engineering. Yeah, totally. So it's like, man, you know, I mean, I understand like some of these positions, probably like engineering, need a college degree, but I don't know if GIS really does. I mean, we have a lot of training that we could probably do to get someone to that position, you know, and mentorship. So, yeah, maybe some of that would help. I don't know. Because even I was like looking at the GIS positions and I don't think one of them really even required a degree, but it was like a 9/11, you know, and I was like, we just need some experience in it, you know, and everything we do pretty much involves GIS anymore. So
I did think a couple of the great succession planning efforts that the agency did specific to fire was one after 2000. We had the first fire hire and we converted a lot of long-term temporary employees into permanent seasonal employees.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was about another 5 years, and we started really implementing fire program management So those qualifications that we were all chasing as individual employees became a necessary thing to apply for the next job. So, you know, as a fire management officer, I always had a expectation if you worked in my program and we were going to hire you as a GS5, I wanted you to be an ICT4 or an ICT4 trainee that was about to get signed off. Because I need an ICT4 for my staffing. And also as the fire management officer, I'd make sure and help get you the experience, get you what you needed in your task book so you could get that ICT4, whether it was on my district or somebody else's.
Yeah.
Well, that became official with fire program management. So even a fire management officer at a district had to be a current ICT3 and or a current division supervisor, and I think a current burn boss too.
Yes, the RXP2.
Yeah, so having those qualification requirements along with starting to build the career ladder when we first started Fire Hire, and I did an assignment early on before Region 1 went to Fire Hire, where I went to Region 4, took some folks with me, and we assessed their Fire Hire to see how it might affect us if we were going to do that. And the report we wrote was, you know, it's probably going to affect diversity, without a doubt. Because it was limiting our certs, the candidates on the certs. Applicants were getting, like we talked about earlier, disqualified early on for bogus reasons. So that, you know, wasn't a favorable prognosis. But when we first started Fire Hire here in Region 1, and the fire staff on the Idaho Panhandle was actually the lead for that, and I'm not dropping names in this, but you'll figure out who it is. Anyways, that started really helping us with successional planning because we had career ladders, we had qualifications requirements. There, after a few years, we actually started being able to get those certs. We'd get VAST certs. We would be able to still use student hiring authorities, so we could actually do some really focused outreach and recruitment if there were people we wanted to try to get. So, yeah, there are things that work. The agency as a whole, I think everybody that's had a long career with them will say this, that it goes in cycles, and we'll probably see the Forest Service cycle back around. Will it ever look like it did before we centralized hiring? And no, but there are things that can be done even with that system in place to address a more diversified pool of employees and do a better job with succession planning.
Yeah, totally. And you know, tag on that a little bit too, like you were talking a little earlier too about some outreach stuff is one of the big complaints in the Region 1. It's not like a really big complaint. It's just kind of like, complaint, but it's more of a, hey, why aren't we doing a better job with our social media? Because you see, like, the National Park Service, who has what seems to be a lot more freedom, and they're doing these funny posts, and, you know, I think it's probably helping their recruitment, and, they, you know, and they have funny ones, and they have these cool stories that they do, and it seems like they have a whole team that's got more and more freedom to post on, like, Instagram and Facebook and everything, and they got a ton of following and big traction, so it's like, you know, like, Is there like a Women in Wildfire Week or something like that that we have?
There are Women in Wildfire programs I'm no longer familiar with.
I can't remember either, but like
current ones.
If we had something like that, you know, like Women in Wildfire Week, and then we could actually do a better outreach with our social media stuff. I think that would go a long way because that was like kind of the, there's, you know, public affairs folks and partnership coordinators there.
Yep.
That's how I ended up there in this Region 1 like conference thing that we did last winter. And it was great because, you know, that was more like the suggestion was like, I mean, if we could kind of free up a little bit more, you know, social media use and let people kind of roam some things and not have to go through all the hurdles. I think that's like, I don't think we really have like a one for the Forest Service. And if it did, it'd have to go through like OC and it would just take forever to get anything out, I think is kind of what the story would be. So if they could stream a little bit more, and even if it's someone through OC, just have like a main person that would like help filter and edit and, you know, you could kind of go back and forth to something before it got released, you know?
Yeah, if you're going to plan for Succession, you're going to have to go reach them where they're at.
Yeah, exactly. With the times. Like, we're all the youth, you know, younger folks, and it's, on their phones.
We still have firefighters' retirement, so we're going to see another wave of people when they reach 57 or 55 leaving the agency.
Yeah, especially if that buyback happens.
Oh, is that in discussion now?
The union's been trying to do it for a little while now, and that's kind of what I'm holding on
and
to.
And they won't exempt fire?
What you mean?
Oh, they've done buybacks in the past, and they've said you can't do it if you're fire.
Yeah, that's
or law enforcement.
Oh, really? Yeah, because I heard that existed like in the 80s. Yep. And so if you like were in the force during the 80s, you could buy back that chunk of time, and then once the 90s or something, it was gone. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was going to be specifically for fire, I think. So like,
oh, I may have misunderstood. You're talking about buying back time, buyout for retirement.
Not a buyout. Right. Because I heard about that too before. Yeah. You know, is the buyout, like, especially if they're going to get rid of your position or because people have been talking about that lately. Because the chief said something about like the attrition rate in the Forest Service isn't what is normal. So. I don't know exactly what was going to become of that, but if they were going to maybe have more incentive to take your retirement when you're eligible versus like, I mean, just no one can afford to retire is I think why it's happening right now. And
it's a personal decision when you make it. It's it's hard for some people to make that decision.
Yes, man, I can totally get it. And especially like, I mean, there's so many programs, not just fire, that like is your life. Like, you know, talk to like NEPA planners who like have been trying to get NEPA through for, you know, some fuel project their whole career pretty much. And so like, they probably don't want to retire until they can get that thing pushed through and see their project finally get, you know, at least put in motion, you know. So like, I get it. But not me. I'd be, if I get that buyback, I'll be out here as soon as I can. But my concern is more the health stuff, you know, like all the new stuff there would come out with the presumptive diseases. Did you see that? Like,
no.
Jonah actually was the first case, I think, because of his tumor. So I think it has a list of different tumors. And if they're cancerous, it's listed in presumptive diseases for the Forest Service wildland firefighters. And I'm trying to think, like, what comes along with it. But I think, like, benefits and retirement, I think, if you have these. And it's just, like, they presume that you got it being a wildland firefighter.
Oh, wow. So. No, I'm completely unaware.
Yeah, I'm not doing a great job of describing it, so apologies. But because I had a tumor on my kidney a couple years ago when I was working for Benji. And So hoping to kind of use that to help get my firefighter retirement back. And because I was forced out of fire because of illness. Yeah. Like, I just couldn't do the job. I'd been absolutely worthless and more of a risk on the fire line because of the tumor in my Crohn's. So.
Okay.
Yeah. But so they're talking about trying to get the buyback as well, because now, you know, like these ladder positions where it's like a 3, 4, 5 or whatever the positions are that are 4, 5s and people are able to start collecting retirement a lot earlier, where like my generation and your generation, like I said, I'm the whole BRD, a perm 6 was the first perm that you could see in fire, you know? So it's like somebody put in 10 years or more just trying to get to a 6, a GS 6 level, starting off at a 3, you know? And then not too many people were leaving. So it was a little more challenging. And so I've got like 12 years or something, you know, built up in seasonal time that doesn't count towards anything. So that'd be huge for me if I could afford it, I guess. We'll see how that goes. But that was supposed to be on the Tim Hart Act, I think, originally. And, but when the Tim Hart Act, at least as far as I understand, when the Tim Hart Act was first presented to Congress, it was huge. And so they had to trim it down and take a few things out. And so I'm not sure where they're at with it now, but.
Okay.
That's one of the things that to help folks maybe get to retirement sooner, you know, and at least eligible sooner for the fire community. I don't know if it'll ever happen, though.
Huh.
I mean, they did in the 80s, so I don't know. But like you said, I don't think it was fire, though. I don't know. I don't know what that entailed.
Yeah, my confusion was about the buyout that occurred in the 80s for retirement. They just didn't let law enforcement or firefighters do it.
Oh, really?
Because they were down. The downsizing during that time was mainly because of the timber program. So it was timber and engineers. And
was it spotted owl stuff going on then?
Yeah, that's when I was in Oregon.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. And Woody Owl took a reprieve.
Yeah, and then we ended up with one of the first forest plans out of the Clinton administration that was the Northwest Forest Plan for all of the national forest in Region 6 on the west side, specifically for managing for the owl. So the whole agency had to adjust at that time. So the agency can adjust. Yeah. I mean, it's those cycles I mentioned. Yeah. Anybody who's been around long enough, it takes a while to actually, turn a ship, but the agency can make adjustments and do what they need to get a workforce in place that they need for the future. They just have to have the awareness that it needs to be done and the will to do it.
Absolutely, yeah, and you know, motivation, like you said, and sometimes a little bit of a push, maybe. I heard rumor that the National Park Service's social media team came about when COVID hit. There was just some rogue employee that was running their Instagram and Facebook, maybe. Instagram for sure, and they were just uploading funny stuff that wasn't bad. It was just, like, not approved and not, like, in the basic, like, come to Yellowstone geyser photo, it was like something funny and geyser photo, and like all these like witty things, and people were at first not real happy about it, but then they saw like the positive feedback they got. I mean, all of a sudden, like overnight, I think they had like millions of followers and likes and a lot more views, on their channels. And so like, oh, maybe we'll keep doing this, and so like they got a little bit of a push, and I think the Forest Service is trying to go that way, but it, like you said, it's just a giant ship and it takes a little bit to course correct or change course. So and then unfortunately it seems like it's always the people who are on their way out that are able to make the change, and they don't seem to benefit from the change, but they help the generations coming up. So maybe that's what's going to happen here. I think I'll probably be part of that a little bit,
Well, the mission of the agencies stayed the course. I certainly believed in the mission while I worked for the agency. I believe in public lands. I think it's one of the greatest ideas this country's ever had.
Yeah.
I believe in access to those public lands for our employees as well as for our public. Totally. And by access for our employees, I mean give people a career ladder, give them opportunity. More remote work seems to be working for people. I've ran into a couple of colleagues that are now still living in Missoula because who can afford to sell and buy a house anymore, but working in Region 8 out of their regional office and doing everything remotely unless they need to go back for specific reasons.
Yeah. And sometimes just like showing up for a training, you know, like once a year or something. And yeah, I mean, so much stuff is online now, and it makes life a lot easier, to have that flexibility. And even if you could, work from home a couple of days a week,
especially, again, if you have a family.
Yeah, 100%. And, I got the opportunity to do that with my detail, and I didn't even realize it, but, like, that was when gas had really spiked, and, I mean, it's still up there, but, like, it was the initial, so, like, I mean, it was kind of gradual, so I didn't really notice, like, the dent it was putting in my wallet every, month or whatever. But, like, once I was home for my 120-day detail, I was like, holy cow, I got a lot more money.
Saving money.
Yeah. And I think that goes a long way for even our employees at the agency and their home life, if they can afford to do maybe more stuff because they don't have to spend their own gas to get to the office every day,
And there are those positions that do have to show up every day,
100%,
where those accommodations can be made. And if employees can move into that type of work setting during a phase of their life where it would be helpful for them and the supervisors are open to it, it'll help with retention.
Retention,
it'll help with that employee's career development. as well as their personal life.
Yeah, yeah, wellness, their mental health. Like you said, where it can, and I always kind of wondered, like, everyone knows that fire beats you up pretty good, you know, after a long career, and especially, like, I'd have to really think about all the hotshots I know, and if I think about almost all of them are blown out knees, you know, because all the weight they're carrying and all the hiking they're doing. So it's like, if we could kind of, you know, if you want to stick in and that's your lifestyle, you know, by all means, but it'd be nice to see like a path where it's like, all right, put in your 10 years, you know, beating the ground up. Like now it's, you know, here's another avenue, like in a like training specialist or something, you know, like to where.
It's funny you mentioned that because the hotshot crew that I said my husband was on, Wolf Creek Hotshot Crew.
Yeah.
I was on that as a squad leader, and what myself and Connie, and she was the other squad leader. But we had a 55-year-old, I think that's how old he was at the time, superintendent, Richard Aguilar. And this was quite some time ago. He's long since retired, but that man was never going to not do that job.
Yeah, totally.
Maybe if he'd been offered a position, if his knees were hurting him, he would have taken it. But just made me flash to like someone like him in a suit position, try to get Borg to take a different job.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. And you know, talk about the fire stuff, like he really kind of explained like his family dynamic and stuff to me, and it was interesting to hear like a different side of somebody who's, like you said, more like Borg, who's you know, he's flathead soup until he can't kind of deal, and but he has a great balance on like what he does with his family and the time he has in fire, and he's like, you know, they all know if the more fire dad gets on, the better Christmas is. So, you know, and then the more fun they have in the off season, you know, he talks about like how then when it's not fire season, it's family time. And that's what we do. And it's like,
That's why our family was big into skiing.
We
didn't get on the river very often, but we were seasons pass at Snowball every year and kids in freestyle and had lots of fun on the local hill.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, kind of find that balance. My personality would be kind of tough for that, I think, you know, like, but I'm older now with kids, I think, so it's different a little bit, I think. I don't know, I think I just see the sand coming out of the hourglass a little bit more now. I'm tickling 40, so I'm like, you know, trying to get all the time I can. But when I was younger, I think I was more of a practical thinker where I was like, you know, this provides for the family. I'm going to go fight fire, and then, you know, the family will be good, and then I get, you know, doing my career and have that balance and kind of try to get a harmony going as best I can, you know, with the work-life balance. But now that I'm older, I'm like, man, you know, like we were talking before, like remote job and stuff that's, because also I can see that, you know, my one kiddo's two, so in 3 more years she'll be in kindergarten, and then, you know, it's like that's when the time starts being less and less, because they're in school and sports and start becoming their own human and, you know, their own person, and you know, not as much time with me, so I'm like valuing that time already because I can see it coming, you know. Maybe I'm a little dramatic with it, but
it's funny you mentioned that, because when our granddaughter was born, I mentioned I had retired, so I was able to help out. But it was also COVID, so Jim was working from home. Our daughter was living with us and going to law school here at the U of M, but doing it remotely.
Oh, awesome.
So everybody was home.
Yeah.
So everybody got to hang out with Hallie and watch her learn to crawl and walk. And and that made it a pretty unique time. If you're going to find, you know, a silver lining in COVID, maybe time with family could be it, depending.
Yeah. Yeah,
right, depending.
Depending, yeah, exactly. I know a lot of people that were like not as happy with that, you know. But yeah, the same way, like the, you know, you got almost like a old school tribal feel to it, where you got the whole family together, and I don't know, it just seemed like time slowed down a little bit during that period, and that's something that kind of how this came to be. Like I was talking to, do you know Sarah Doring?
Yeah, I know Sarah.
Yeah, so I was talking to her, and we were talking at the Man Gulch thing and about how like fire folks are kind of more introverts. I'm just generalizing, but it, and my basis for that is, well, not only myself, but like every time a news camera comes out, everyone's just like, nope, you know? So like, this is kind of rare for a fire person to want to be on that. And then like, so like even this, you know, having like a fire person starting a podcast is a little more rare because, it seems like most of us in the fire community don't want the spotlight at all. You know, like we're quite professionals more in a sense. And, but like when I was in COVID, I was like, just thinking about, well, I was laid up, I had the tumor, yeah, the tumor, right? Well, I had the tumor during, but I didn't know about it, I think, until like after COVID was over. So I kind of had like a longer period of getting laid up, because then I was on light duty until I could get surgery, and I had to go to Mayo Clinic. It was kind of a big deal, but had a lot of time to like sit around and think about things. And there was a lot, also like we lost a few people between when I jumped and when you probably knew Ed Lynn and Margarita Phillips, mm-hmm. and you know, like they went really fast.
Yes.
Like all of a sudden I saw Margarita at the jump base. Yep. Next thing I know, she's gone. Like,
yeah.
And they were having like
that was quick.
That was, yeah, it was nuts. Yeah. So sad. And she was, she was a soup of the Great Northern when I was mm-hmm. on the Great Northern, the first go around when I was a squad boss for him back in 2012. And hearing some of the stories then, I was like, holy cow, you know, what a tough lady, you know, and she's running ultra marathons then. And, she's giving us all advice about if we wanted to take the smoke jumper path and I wanted to. So I was like, you know, trying to sponge in all the information and all of a sudden, like, I want to say it was like a 75th anniversary for the jump base or something. I don't know if that's right, but it was, you know, there was some kind of anniversary for smoke jumping, and it was at Missoula Jump Base, and I was a jumper at the time, so I hadn't seen Margarita since 2012, and it was like 2015 or something maybe, and 2014 maybe, I can't remember, but like, it was like her and all the smoke jumper gals that were there were going to have a little girl party at the DraftWorks, you know, and I was like, oh, very cool, you know, I was like, I wish I could be on a fly on the wall for that, you know, I'd love to hear these stories, is my thought even back then, not thinking about something like this, because I didn't really know about podcasting then, but then all of a sudden she was gone, and then all of a sudden, like, Ed Lynn was gone, I don't remember which one first, but I think it was Margarita, then Ed, and then, like, we started losing more people that I had known that had, like, these great stories of them coming up in fire and experiences that died with them. And I was like, man, I remember like being on Willow Mountain Lookout and just thinking about those kind of people and just being like, man, someone needs to get that, you know, that information down. And I was talking to Tanner, the lookout, and then he had no interest because he has a music career he's following. I was like, and it was kind of like one of those, why not me kind of moments. Like, someone needs to do something about this, and it's like almost like the supervisor thing that you want to be the supervisor so you don't get the bad supervisor. Mm-hmm. It was kind of that situation. Like, I didn't really want to do it, but I was like, man, so many good stories and great folks that have come through the fire world and big brains. I mean, we downplay ourselves all the time. But I was talking to, I feel like I'm name dropping after, but you know, I was talking to Jason Ramos about this, like, man, we're always just kind of downplaying what we do and you know, just like ditch diggers in the woods. But like, really, there's a lot of highly intelligent people out there in the woods, you know?
Yeah.
And I always felt like I was definitely on the lower end of the intelligence spectrum when I was on, fire crews. So there were so many interesting, intelligent folks I was working with and really enjoyed that part of aspect of fire, you know?
Yeah, I think all the colleagues I've had over the years, the best fun is usually with the ones I've done the most challenging fire assignments with.
Yeah, totally.
And gotten through them, scathed or unscathed. But yeah, it was that camaraderie and the communication and the understanding of each other that really made the situation end well.
yeah totally. And it brings out, I don't know, the funny or the best, I don't even know if it's that real accurate of like what it brings out in fire folks when it's in a shitty fire situation.
Yeah, there's a real humanity there.
yeah talking to a few folks about that, like, where, you know, you'll be holding, you know, and then 2 a.m, you know, and just like sitting there staring, you know, into this fire that's not doing a whole lot, and you are running on no sleep and busting your hump all day. and all of a sudden someone will say something that is maybe not that funny in a normal conversation, yeah, but like at that time it's the funniest thing you ever heard in your life. And then all of a sudden like everyone's laughing and joking, and you know, like those moments are so priceless, and not everyone gets to experience that, you know. Yeah.
There are a lot of benefits to the career in fire management, and I believe that's still true. Yeah. And the people you work with are one of the biggest benefits.
Yeah.
And then for me, it set me up in retirement to do something different that's challenging and interesting. Oh. And lets me interact with emergency managers in other countries.
Yeah, you're just saying. Hi.
And yeah, and go work as a technical advisor if they're dealing with specifically wildfire events. And in some of those places, their FEMA, you know, like our FEMA, is literally brand new, like maybe 6 months old.
Oh, yeah.
So they're still figuring out how to just organize around emergency management and disaster and risk management. So it's easy to bring something to the table to benefit them.
Oh, that's very cool. And especially having like a long career like you have and having that knowledge to be able to see people probably like, oh, that's awesome, thank you, you know. Mm-hmm. like that right away, you're like, oh yeah, it's just kind of the world that we all grew up in, you know. But it's like to them, yeah, you know, I heard that happen with other natural disasters. Like they would talk about our incident command structure and how, yeah, fast we can set up an ICP, incident command post, right? ICP.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the wildland world. And so, you know, like all these other agencies were wanting to adopt our system because of how efficient it is.
Yeah.
And so you getting to share that is super cool. Cause I never knew outside the US that it was a function, but I knew like with hurricanes and other, you know, natural disasters, they were trying to implement some of our systems because of how good we are doing it, you know? So that's really cool that you're going. Is it year round then, or?
I'm doing it part time.
Oh, gotcha.
So that I have control over my availability after, you know, not having control over my availability for numerous decades.
Yeah, it's a downside.
But so it could be as much or as little work as I wanted. But, you know, the point is the career is what set me up for that. So if I'd worked for a different agency, done something other than wildland fire management, this opportunity that really came to light in 2019, like 6 months before I retired, it wouldn't have looked the same, that's for certain.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, and you probably, well, let me know if you've experienced this, but I've never experienced it, especially like being a little older and having a little more maybe like introspection, but like things seem to kind of come, opportunities seem to come like when you're ready almost. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm kind of, you know, referring to this a bunch, but like, even like this, you know, like as a young smoke jumper, I wouldn't have the patience for it probably, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think I would have done it justice if I would have tried to start this back then. Cause once in a while I kick myself, I'm like, man, I should start kind of planning my exit strategy a little earlier, yeah, and maybe start this hobby and then it'd be going now and I wouldn't have to work, you know, have this as a hobby, this could be my main job, which is the goal, you know. It's like, oh, just things, you know, seem to work out in the time frame they do, you know. And
yep,
just like your, you know, your newfound work, you know, if that was presented years before you retired, you're probably like,
quite ready,
yeah,
yet.
Exactly. Like, it sounds interesting, but I'm kind of good right where I'm at, kind of deal, you know. And so it's interesting how life kind of has that like flow to it if you kind of take, yep, a step back. Yeah, something else I was going to ask you for. Oh, just to tag on that too about like the community, like the putt and pull where, you know, I got to know you a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I think before I'd ran in passing, you know, but you were, way above me on the food chain. So like, I was probably nervous to talk to you. So, you know, it was cool because, you know, you retired fire. I just recently gotten out of fire and being able to talk to you and your husband and like, and I'm older now and not as like a nervous little firefighter guy anymore. So it's like, I mean, still a little bit intimidating, you know, cause you've got an awesome fire career. So, but it's great to have these conversations and be able to like hang with you at the putt and pull, you know, like everything's winding down. I'm just breaking this thing down to bring it home. And, you know, like, you and McClay.
You couldn't get rid of McClay and, yeah, Benji and,
yeah,
me.
Yeah. And then CJ popped in and Clint, yeah, you know, Mendenhall popped, yep, in, and it was great. It was like, man, That's what I want to kind of recreate, is that fire kind of hang with something like
oh,
this.
Oh, I remember Benji and McClay Schulte Hyphen were saying we should just get around a table and you should have this conversation between numerous people that have worked together in fire.
Absolutely.
Because then that feeling would really come through of that camaraderie and that friendship that just those shared experiences provide.
Yep, absolutely. And that's kind of what I was getting into, is that, you know, because like, you know, I didn't know much about your fire background at that point, but, you know, two of my good buddies had worked for you. So then all of a sudden these stories start flowing, you know, and when you started by coming into the Airstream with your story, and then that they started tagging on and asking you questions.
Yeah.
And it was great because I was just sitting back and listening, and I was like, yeah, this is part of the reason why I got this going. And, you know, then CJ came in and Clint and everything else, you know, so it was great. But that kind of family that lasts out of wildland fire is, I guess, really my long point I was working into, is why I think folks should get in wildland fire. You know, I've been there for a while, like with the tumor and my health stuff, I was like kind of not really, you know, cheery leading for the wildland fire world, because I was like, I'm broken. But now that I'm like taking a step back, I'm getting my health back and having these conversations with you and being at the putt and pull and these fundraisers and just getting back to like what made me want to be a wildland firefighter in the first place, really, was, you know, the excitement and the community.
Yep.
And then getting back with the community and re-engaging in a different capacity has been awesome. So like,
well, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. I didn't even know who Smokey the Bear was, and I moved out west when I was 18.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could have planned a better career.
Yeah.
And opportunity to have a family. I mean, I met Jim on a fire crew, so pretty much fire management is why I am where I'm at today.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I didn't ask you actually when you're going through kind of the history of like your family in fire. Did any of your kids still in fire?
No. They Jake is in Bozeman, our oldest, and Logan is here in Missoula, and our daughter's here in Missoula, Aspen also.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they all chose different fields.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to have the generational thing, I think. You know, there's a few of us, you know, like that seem to be like second and third generation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the generation that maybe followed us up, or, you know, like saw, I don't know, how much time it takes of your life, and
yes,
maybe thought
our
different
kids have shared that with us.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
They, I mean, they all found their own path, and they're all in good places, and I'm really happy for them. But they also saw how much we work, spent away from home, and how we had to really work to try to balance things. And sometimes, you know, we weren't successful. Balancing isn't, it doesn't happen all the time.
No, it sounds like you guys did a great job, though. You know, it's just...
Well, the state didn't come and take the kids away, so I think we did just
fine. Right, yeah. Yeah, they're all functioning, and
yeah.
Yeah, everyone's alive still.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a huge plus. Oh, shoot, I think that's about all I got tonight for you, Laura, unless you got anything else you want to share.
No, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, thanks. And actually, you kind of cued something I was going to say, so last thing, final message or note, I guess, is... The roundtable thing with the Hyphen and you and Benji, like, that's definitely a teaser I wanted to kind of throw out there for one, if you'd be up for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you should put some thought into you have a big enough network, put some thought into those groups and, like, you know, do the supervisor and this was my first job group kind of thing.
Oh.
Do the smoke jumper thing. Get some themes around that. I think people would really enjoy hearing those free-flowing conversations from some of the bigger characters that are out there.
Yeah, totally. And I guess on that thread, you think it'd be good to like even do like a females in wildfire and have like a almost like a panel of gals who've been in the agency or
get
been in wildfire.
Get someone young, someone old, and someone in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah, and just have them kind of talk about their experiences.
Yep.
And I think it'd be great too, and great for the listeners to kind of hear from, you know, all the experiences, you know. And yeah, like you said, different programs, you know, jumpers and hot shots, repellers.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that'd be good. Well, cool. Well, hopefully that'll be to come.
Your next
idea.
Project.
Yeah, next project. Well, thanks again, Laura.
All right.
Really appreciate you.
Take care.
Yeah, you too. And everyone have a good night. Appreciate you tuning in.
All right.
Bye.